issue, obviously, because there's kids live in all kinds of different circumstances. But knowing that statistic, do you have some specific recommendation of teens of color?
It's a comfort level issue. I think that many people who make job decisions live in worlds where they have little contact with Black and Latino young people, and therefore they come with assumptions sometime. They don't have the comfort level with them. I tell everyone, go out and if you have white friends or you have friends from different ethnic backgrounds, network with them, get to know their parents, and maybe their parents can be the one who will refer you to the job. In this type of economy, whether you're an adult or a young person, it's all about that network. It's all about that personal relationship. I teach in summer internship programs for several big financial institutions. And what I've seen is the number of Black and Latino students actually go down over a period of time. And I wondered why. And to me, it's just that the people making the decisions don't know them.
So be known. Make yourself known.
Make yourself known. Don't be shy about it. You may think it's pushy, but if you don't ask, you don't receive.
Let's talk about working conditions, though. You know, obviously there's this tension often between older people and younger people. People think that younger people are a little bit tender when it comes to hard work. That seems to be like a hardy perennial.
Yes.
But what do you suggest if a work environment really does seem to be abusive? Either the hours are longer than had been expected, or the language is not what I think a lot of people consider appropriate, or even worse. I mean, if there's, it seems like there's some actual harassment going on. What do you recommend that a teen do, particularly given that the competition's so stiff out there?
Talk to your parents or talk to a trusted adult. You need somebody to give you guidance in this case.
Have you ever encountered something like that, or have you ever advised somebody in that situation?
Yes. I actually know of a young man who was working in a job where the language that they were using was just not right. And I said to him he should go and talk to his parents and take his mother in with him and have his mother talk about it. That set into, well, what it did, it set off a whole course of little events, and eventually he lost that job because the person was offended. But that's a risk that you take when you bring in another person. But it's better that he got fired from that job or lost that job rather than stay and endure the abuse.
Why do you say that? What's the line for you? What's the line? Is it when you think your mental or physical health is at stake, or your values are being compromised in a way that you can't accept? Where's the line for you at which you say you really need to speak up?
I think when it becomes something that you are obsessing about or that you feel diminishes you in any way, walk out the door or bring in somebody to help mitigate. Just because somebody tells you to wash a floor, that shouldn't be an issue. But if it's a consistent pattern of demeaning behavior, the way the person talks to you, the way they betray agreements that you've reached with them, bring in somebody to help mitigate. Because I think as a young person, learning how to negotiate that situation is one of the life skills that summer jobs can provide.
On a happier note, for our happier final note here, let's say that you've had a really great experience that summer and you just love what you're doing and you'd like to come back. Is there something you can suggest as a way to kind of improve your chances of being asked back? It's interesting. We were talking yesterday with a colleague about like writing a thank you note, for example. Some people would think of that as kind of brown nosing, right? They think, oh,
no,
you know, and some people
no.
think some people would think that's entirely appropriate. What do you recommend?
I think all of those old-fashioned things, like a handwritten thank you note instead of an email, telling the person how much you enjoy the job, saying that if there's other work available during holidays, during the Christmas season, or whenever, you'd like to come back. All of that expresses your desire and enthusiasm for the work. Do it. I cannot tell you how important it is to write that thank you note by hand. And every parent should go out and get their kid nice little stationery just so it comes in. And people will cherish that because it shows not only that they appreciate the job, but they understand good manners.
Alvin Hall is a financial author and educator. He was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Alvin Hall, thank you.
You're most welcome.
And I'm going to write you a beautiful thank you note, too.
Thank you. I love receiving them.
Let's talk now about a venture in the tech world that's going on this week. Now, we've often talked about the role technology can play in changing the world and how tech players are trying to reach out beyond their own borders. Well, this week, we're seeing both those ideas come together in Silicon Valley as top tech entrepreneurs from across the Middle East and North Africa head to Silicon Valley to visit places like Twitter, Facebook, and Google. These entrepreneurs will be brainstorming with successful CEOs, learning how to expand their companies, and getting tips on pitching to investors. We wanted to hear more about it, so we've called journalist Nafisa Saeed. She's reported extensively on entrepreneurship in the tech world. She's actually headed out to this conference later this week, and she is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. I do want to mention also that you were one of our Twitter contributors around our Women in Tech series back in March, so it's good to see you in person.
Thanks so much, Michelle. It's great to be here.
So whose idea was this? Who put this conference together?
This conference is the brainchild of several different groups, including the MIT Enterprise Forum that has held startup competitions across the Arab world, as well as Tech Wadi, which is a nonprofit that builds bridges between Silicon Valley and the Arab world.
And what does Wadi mean in Arabic, by the way?
Wadi means valley, hence Tech Wadi.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So you've, as we mentioned, you've done a lot of research on female entrepreneurship and startups in general. Who are some of the people who are coming to this conference?
This week, they have a variety of entrepreneurs ranging from publishing, e-publishing, to health services. A couple that I can mention in particular include a group called Tamatam out of Jordan, and they're a mobile gaming studio and publisher. And they say they're trying to create culturally specific games for what they identify 60 million smartphone users in the Arab world and who are seeking Arab-speaking content. And then another is called Karm Solar, which is out of Egypt, and they're looking to replace diesel power with solar energy because they say it's not only eco-friendly, but also more affordable and more reliable as well.
You know, we talked a lot, I think a lot of Americans who followed events in the Arab Spring heard a lot about the role that technology played. But I get the sense from you that these entities, I'm just wondering, were these entities or any of these entities influenced by the Arab Spring in any way? Most of these are kind of basic products that people would want to use. But do you know what I'm saying?
So, I would say that entrepreneurship has become a huge buzzword since the Arab Spring. Some people identify it as sort of the grand articulation of the entrepreneurial spirit of the Arab world. But I would also say that it's not new. It has been around before. In our book, Arab Women Rising, we cite several examples of women who started tech companies in the early 90s. They talk about what it was like to convince people to use the internet early on. But at the same time, this has been definitely a huge boon in terms of the momentum people have and how can I change things? How can I use different tools to kind of change society? And there's definitely a momentum built around that. And you see lots of organizations, both international organizations, U.S. government, pouring money into the idea of entrepreneurship. But then you also have a huge ecosystem that has evolved with local incubators in the Arab world, nurturing local entrepreneurs.
You mentioned women earlier. That is also another focus of your reporting. It's kind of ironic that there's this focus on women entrepreneurs when, as we've just discussed just recently, Silicon Valley has its own issues around the lack of diversity, you know, both gender and ethnic, and also kind of the growing sense that the environment itself is not as hospitable to people of different backgrounds as many people think they would like it to be, and that it should be, given its purpose and importance in our society. I wanted to ask, with the women entrepreneurs that you've been reporting on, what do they say about the role that gender plays in their lives as entrepreneurs? What do they say? So, similar experiences?
One of the things my co-author Rahila Zephyr and I both were struck by was the number of women we met who are studying computer science and engineering, whereas here in the U.S., we still have an ongoing discussion of how do we get our girls to be interested in science and tech, whereas there, that's already happening with a lot of the women we met. So you have a convergence of a lot of different forces coming together that have pushed women into the tech field in the Arab world. You have more women pursuing higher ed in many countries, more women outnumber men. You have more women entering the workplace, and then you have more women becoming breadwinners for their families, in addition to then the very high internet penetration rates. So all of that combined, you see sort of women being pushed into the tech world. Now, in terms of whether gender played a role, in my interviews with dozens of women, we asked, has gender played a role? Do you ever feel like it has held you back? And there were actually many women, several of the women who said gender has never been an issue of getting ahead. And they actually decried and criticized women that do think that gender has held them back. But then there were other women that did tell us that there were some social attitudes or social cultural issues that may have gotten in the way sometimes. So for instance, if a woman has products where she has to go to a supplier or factories or certain parts of town that maybe her family's not comfortable with her going, or these are male-dominated areas that she had to sort of assert herself in a different way that she's not used to. We also asked the women to be very candid about their managing their work and family lives. And so there again, you see maybe their gender coming up as an issue where some of their families thought they needed to make their home the priority and not their work. While some told us their husbands and their fathers or brothers actually encouraged them to continue their business, some whose spouses may not have shared their vision ended up getting divorced because they weren't able to continue doing both.
I think those are stories that will sound very familiar to many, many, many people here. Well, so tell us a little bit more about what the various participants are hoping to accomplish this week. And recognizing, you know, you're heading out at the end of the week to present, so we hope that goes well. But how? Tell us a little bit more about what the people participating hope to accomplish, and what are people who are receiving these entrepreneurs hope to get out of this exchange as well?
My sense is, you know, when I'm talking to people in the region, talking to young entrepreneurs, they're fascinated and they glean a lot of knowledge and inspiration from the experiences in Silicon Valley and look to some of those people as their heroes and something they want to emulate in a way in their own work. But when it comes to the knowledge of what's needed or what technology makes sense and what programs, what software will make sense, it's only going to be the people from the region who can actually develop that. So I think they're going there, my sense, a lot of them might be their dream to go to visit Google or Twitter and learn what they can, but also have an exchange. So see what ideas they could learn from Silicon Valley, but also let Silicon Valley know what it is that they're doing and how they're innovating in ways that Silicon Valley may have never seen actually before.
And just looking at the list of the entrepreneurs who were invited, they all seem young. Is that correct? Is there kind of an average age? I mean, they all seem to be kind of hovering around their 30s. Am I right about that? And is that generally the way, the wave of the future? It's young. Techwadi is young.
Right? Sure. There's a huge, obviously, they call it the youth bulge. In a lot of these countries, you have a very young population. And technology is just, you know, from a young age being eaten up by these young people. And you also have to keep in mind that a lot of the problems and issues that facing these societies, whether it's such as high unemployment, who's going to create opportunities, even amid the turmoil and other huge issues and challenges going on, sort of taking matters into their own hands. And again, I would say from the Arab Spring, they're taking that inspiration of how can we create new realities for ourselves.
I've been speaking with Nafisa Saeed. She's co-author of the digital book Arab Women Rising, 35 Entrepreneurs Making a Difference. She's been telling us about a conference going on in Silicon Valley this week. It's called The Arab World Meets Silicon Valley. She's headed out there to present at the conference, but she was kind enough to stop here first in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Coming up, there are shelves of books, tons of blogs, and loads of free advice for new moms. But what about dads? Just in time for Father's Day, our Parenting Roundtable offers tips for dads from dads. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com, code NPR. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, John Waters. His new book, Carsick, is about hitchhiking cross-country. Part of the book is fiction, in which he imagines best-case scenarios, like being picked up by his favorite porn star, and worst-case scenarios, like getting a ride with a killer who has it in for cult film directors like Waters. Then Waters tells the story of what really happened. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products for hospitals and patients throughout our region. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. More information is at bloodservices.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The annual Summer Harp class at the University of Illinois happens this week, Thursday through Saturday. Besides classes and presentations by and for harpists, there will also be several performances open to the public. We'll have two of those performers, the harp duo Ginger and Spice, play for us live on the Tuesday edition of Live and Local. We'll also hear from half of the harp and bass Rivertown duo. Live and Local airs weekdays at 4 p.m. on FM 90.9.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, just in time for Father's Day weekend, we are focusing on what new and experienced dads need. We're not talking about a new tie, soap on a rope, or a bottle of Old Spice, although those are nice, but we're talking about the best advice for meeting the big and small challenges of fatherhood. So joining us to share their best tips and maybe even a mistake or two, not that that's ever happened, in fatherhood are Lester Spence. He's the father of five and a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. Phil Lerman is author of Dadditude, How a Real Man Became a Real Dad. He's the father of one and a stepdad of one. Bracton Booker, producer at NPR, is the brand new father of a three-week-old son. Let's see if he can keep his eyes long enough to get through this conversation. They're all here in our Washington, D.C. studios. And with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California, is Dan Bukatinski. He is an actor and a writer and the adoptive father of two. He's the author of Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? Confessions of a Gay Dad. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
And thank happy you. Father's Day, and congratulations to the new dad. So, Phil, let me start with you. You had your son Max a little later in life, and your book, you talk about how you thought your long career in management would prepare you for fatherhood. It didn't.
What happens when you're a manager is that you think you can control the world around you. I was at a TV show called America's Most Wanted, where we thought we could save the world by taking criminals off the street. And what a baby does is takes your belief in order and stuffs cheese balls in its ear. Because what you learn very early on, and what you try to learn, is that there is a chaos that comes with children. And if you can learn to embrace that chaos rather than try to fight it, life gets a little bit easier. It never gets easy, but it gets less difficult if you stop struggling against the chaos that's all around you.
Is that the main thing you wish you had known before you became a dad?
No, the main thing I wish I had known is that you should sleep before the baby's born because you don't sleep later.
Yeah, but you're too busy putting together that furniture from IKEA.
which is what most people think all dads are good for.
Lester Spence,
hey.
You wear the crown with the five.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, right. What's the best advice you wish you had gotten before you had kids?
Save loot, save loot, save loot. So I started when I was really, really young. I was like 23 or 24. And I just thought that once my career started, I'd be able to kind of catch up. And it just never quite happened like that. So that's the thing. It's like that loot. If to the extent you can plan, like, try to save as much loot as you can because they need it.
Dan, what about you? You and your husband are raising a boy and a girl. Is there some advice you really wish you'd had before you started on that journey of being a dad?
Don't do it.
Oh,
gangster.
I'm kidding.
No. I love being a dad. And obviously, every day wound up being a surprise, everything you think you could prepare for. That book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, there are so many things that you can't possibly expect that are probably new to every parent and very unique to each kid. I think the biggest thing I've learned, and now my kids are 9 and 6, is to quiet the inner voice, you know, to try to become the dad I wish I could be for myself first, because I'm telling you, the screaming I do at myself, my daughter asked me for a training bra the other day, and I started screaming in my head, oh my God, she's on her way to doing porn. And truthfully, when my boy wants a sword, or suddenly at the same time wants to wear pink nail polish like his sister, or my daughter wants a training bra, or the hardest lesson I think I've had to learn is to quiet my inner screaming and embrace everything that they are turning into with a kind of calm and acceptance that I wish, you know, that you sort of wish your inner daddy had towards you.
How do you do that? How do you calm your inner screaming besides bourbon?
Therapy, meditation, and it's also like I do this. You know, I'm an actor, so I try to act as if I literally. I'm not kidding here. There are times I literally try to act like the dad I know I should be in the moment, and that started very early. We were given a lot of advice, especially because we're both dads. You know, the bonding experience when we had newborns, we had been told to not to be afraid, especially for those who have, you know, a few day old child or a few weeks old, to take off your shirt and don't be afraid to embrace the mommy or the maternal side inside of you. And I think that was a huge learning curve for us. We weren't afraid to play different gender roles, even in our own, well, we don't have a choice because there's no mommy in our household. But I think a lot of times dads can embrace even sort of a maternal instinct, for lack of a better word, and that you wind up being kind of nurturing towards the child and you wind up being more nurturing towards yourself.
So Bracton, go ahead, jump in here.
Dan, I do want to comment on the whole, you know, taking the shirt off and trying to embrace the mommy role. My son is 3 weeks old. You know, love him to death. I feel like he looks exactly like me, although my wife does not think so. She's like, oh, no, he has my hands. I'm like, well, no, okay. No, he has my face, though.
But I got to tell you, she just carried the package. Kid is all you. No offense.
But I have not had so much success with taking the shirt off, because my son is a booby monster at this point. Oh. So everything, like if he feels skin, he's going into attack mode. So we have not really, I've tried to have a discussion with him, but like, I cannot give you what your mother gives you. Like I've dubbed my wife as a CFO. She's the chief feeding officer, and I am the head of the CDC. I'm the chief diaper changer.
And that she's in charge of incoming and you're in charge of outgoing.
Pretty much. So right. I've lucked up and I've not gotten the major explosion. She's tend to gotten all of that, but we're cool on so far.
Let me get this. Are you feeling left out? And are you asking Dan because Dan doesn't have those
doesn't have
the equipment. So are you asking him how to deal with feeling left out?
There is a part of me that wants to get beyond, you know, doing the errands and you know, taking the baby away from my wife when she needs, you know, a couple of hours of sleep. Like, that I feel like is my bonding time with my son. But the whole, you know, nurturing him, having him up against my skin, that's not worked for me, because he immediately goes into feeding mode.
All right, well, Dan, yes. Go ahead. Jump in.
No, I mean, I can't really, you bring up a really good point. I mean, in our case, if there is an actual mom in the household, it's going to be tough to compete. Although there are times when I feel emotional and my boobs hurt and I think I'm getting hormonal. But I think that it helped that we were bottle feeding our kids. I think at a point where, and again, this is such a personal thing for every family, if you're at a point where the dad even can bottle feed a little bit, even pumped milk, that to feed with your shirt off just gives the baby a little bit additional bonding with dad. We also did another thing, which was rather than our baby always had a pacifier, but there are times where literally just putting your pinky and letting them suck and sort of mimicking that. Again, mm-hmm. It's not about trying to be like a mom, but for us, it was just a way of bonding, especially because we adopted, creating that from birth, that sort of bonding experience, letting them feel skin, letting them have the suck urge soothed. And then, of course, when there's a bottle, it's a great thing to be able to look in their eyes while they're feeding. And that is probably coming down the pike because it sounds like it's early still.
It's early still. If you're just joining us, we're having our regular parenting roundtable today. We are focusing on advice for dads from dads. Our guests are Dan Bukatinski, dad of two. That's who was speaking just now. Bracton Booker, he welcomed his first son recently, his first child just 3 weeks ago, and he's doing a great job of staying awake while we're having this conversation. Lester Spence is a father of five, and Phil Lerman is a dad and a stepfather of two altogether. Okay, let's worst mistake, Phil.
See, but the problem that we're talking about here, it doesn't stop after the baby is born. Because Let's face it, when the baby's born, the mother is God. Mm-hmm. I gave you life, and I gave you sustenance. And so father sort of steps back and is the second-class citizen. And if you don't do something about it, that doesn't go away. When I went on the tour with Dadditude, every mother came up to me and had the same story to tell. My husband is an idiot. My husband doesn't know how to hold the baby. He doesn't know how to feed the baby. If he holds it, he doesn't support the head right. He doesn't know how to dress the baby. And every father, if you don't do something about that, steps back and becomes the second-class citizen. And it's really important for dads to fight against that.
How do you fight against it?
Well, one of the doctors I talked to said that what the mothers are doing is called gatekeeping. Same thing you see in the office place. Every editor who ever worked for me, oh, this reporter gave me a stupid story. Good thing I was here to fix that, right? And so there's a gatekeeping function that mothers do, which makes them feel important because my husband's an idiot, therefore I have to do it. So it's a conversation the father and the mother have to have. You want to have a partner, you want to have two people in this relationship, the father's got to hang in there. Like, you got to change the diapers like you do, yes, right? Because, yes, you know, if you can change a tire, you can change a diaper. The lug nuts are a lot looser on a diaper.
Okay, well, you know what? I have a cure for that. Have twins. I'm just letting you know right now, all hands on deck, yo. All hands
real
on deck.
Talk,
all right. Lester, do you mind sharing? It's like the first mistake. A mistake that you made that you wish you could do over?
You know, because they just kept coming. You know, I just there's no do over I'd have, but I just, this is you got a black boy, right?
I do. And
this is the one thing I, as the father of a black boy, given all the things that we have, all the my brothers keep, that whole thing, the one thing I would tell you that's not a mistake, but that's something I did, I'm pretty proud of. I raised my boys, I have boys and girls. I raised my boys to be excellent, but not necessarily to be respectable, right? So I did not give them, they have never heard from me that you got to be twice as good line, or, you know, if you don't pull your pants up, you're disrespecting, you know, black people. It's like, no, you know, I'm raising them. And on top of that, I was the authority figure, but I still allowed them to have an anti-authoritarian streak, even, or to express anti-authority opinions, even with me. Right, because you want your boys to be fighters, you want them to be respectable, you want your boys to be excellent, and you want them to be fighters. And you're the best person. You and your wife are the best people to actually teach them.
How does that strike you, Bracton?
That I haven't heard that anti-authoritarian spiel before. And primarily, I think it's because I don't really have that experience to draw on. I did not grow up with a father in the home. Have not seen my father since I was 11. So I think that really kind of, I don't know if it clouded my judgment as far as like what my thoughts of what a father was going to be like.
Where are you going to get that from? Who's your role model?
Well, I mean, I have several role models. My father-in-law was, my wife's father was an excellent role model. I have uncles. I have my wife's uncles. I have people like Lester who I really respect. But I feel like I'm still in the process of trying to figure out what kind of father I'm going to be. Even now, dealing with my 3 week old, you know, I've tried different things. Like when he's making noise, especially he was crying during the last 2 minutes of the NBA Finals on Sunday, and I was like, no, we are not going to have that right now. We are not going to have that right now. So
I love that you're still trying to like negotiate with him, and he's 3 weeks old. Are his eyes open yet? Maybe you could wait till he has teeth. I don't know. I'm just wondering if maybe
they could do that and walk around as I was saying it.
Oh, well, see, there you go.
So I couldn't just sit down and say it. So he's not listening just yet.
Dan, who was your role model? Who do you have a role model as a dad? Is there somebody that you go to when you need some advice or support or a pat on the back?
Well, I definitely call on the other dads in my circle. You know, I meet other dads on the schoolyard, other moms, you know, and also my spouse. I as much as I fight with him, and we're somewhat competitive at times, and we certainly, I make better lunches than he does. There's no question, and I tend to take care of all those things. But I learn a lot, I think, from watching other dads handle similar situations and frustrations, sometimes in a better way. And the nature-nurture issue is constantly coming up for us because, you know, our children were adopted from birth, but there's all kinds of interesting, exciting, and terrifying mysteries that exist just naturally because we don't necessarily recognize ourselves in our kids. The anti-authority thing is working really nicely with both my kids. I haven't had to do one thing.
That's good. I have one question for Phil, which came in from a listener, actually, who heard that we were going to talk about this today. And she is a mom, but she wanted to flag that some of the most difficult and serious issues facing a marriage is what happens when the darling babies grow up and go off to college. She said, I did not have a clue. So, you know, facing, you know, how to handle the children's exit, middle age, facing mortality, returning to being just a husband and his middle-aged grieving wife. And she says that her experience was that fathers have no clue about the transition, feels like, and as a result, big mistakes are made. She put in all caps, and she just wondered if you had some advice, you know, about that.
Well, mothers think fathers have no clue about everything, so we're starting from a very strong place.
I feel you.
Having had one go off to college and one who's still in the home, the only thing I can say is that what's most important at every stage, your children teach you, is to be in the moment, to be here now. My role model in this is Baba Ramdas, who, when we were back in our hippie days, used to teach us, be here now. And the other role model is my son, who teaches me to be here now, to be in the moment. Kids are always in the moment. They believe no other moment exists. And so if you listen to your children and you savor each moment as it comes and be there and don't be distracted and don't be on your cell phone and don't be doing other things and don't think, oh, everything will be fine once we get them here or there. If you're in the moment, then that's how you treasure every moment in life. And what you have to learn to do is treasure this moment as well, because everything you've done is to prepare them to be out in the world. And if you've been a good parent, as I'm sure you have been, then you have prepared them for this moment to go out on stage. Mm-hmm. And when they go out on stage and the audience is looking at them, that's a great, exciting moment for them. And if you can be in that moment with them and think of their thrill and their excitement in that moment, then you can feel that excitement for them as well. The other thing that's great is nobody's coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning drunk, so that's really good too.
That's really well. That's one hope. Braxton, I'm going to put you on the spot and I apologize, but okay. What are you afraid of and who can help you with that? Who's Ooh. Here now who can help you with that?
Messing up. I mean, I think that's every parent's fear, but, you know, trying to overcompensate for what I didn't have growing up. So being that overprotective parent, you know, making sure that my son grows up trying to be perfect, even though I was never perfect. Now, I think I turned out pretty well.
I think you did pretty well.
But, yeah, that part of trying to make sure I'm the perfect father and maybe smothering my child and pushing him away.
Who can help you with that right now? Who do you want to hear from?
Lester? I'd like to hear from all the dads, actually.
We have 30 seconds. I'm sorry.
Okay, Lester,
all right,
go
Lester,
ahead.
Take it home.
Yeah, real quick. Just work on making sure your kid is better than you and then love yourself enough to know that you're imperfect and your kid will be okay. You know, I mean, it's about really not, I mean, every day you've got to be there. He said it right. Be here now. Every day you've got to be there. You're going to make mistakes. That's the nature of the game. That's the nature of the game.
Thank you all so much. Happy Father's Day to all of you.
Thank you
all so much. Thanks for your willingness to share your thoughts with, yes, I'm being a girl about it. Yes, I am going to start to cry.
Woman.
So I'm going to get out of here.
Woman.
Thank you. Phil Lerman is the parent of two, the author of Daditude, How a Real Man Became a Real Dad. Lester Spence is the father of five, a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. Braxton Booker is the new father of a three-week-old, our colleague at NPR. And Dan Bukatinski has two children with his partner, with his husband. His book is titled, Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? Confessions of a Gay Dad. Thank you all so much for joining
you.
Us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.